Hello and welcome to the Talking Information Center. I'm Ron Clark, reading the Taunton Daily Gazette on Tuesday, February 17th. First article, Meg the Therapist Visits Stressless Workshop by Jansen McNair. Close your eyes and picture a lemon. This was the instruction given to juniors at Southeastern Regional Vocational Technical High School during the Stressless Workshop on January 29th, centered around giving students coping strategies for managing stress. Megan Anderson, known as Meg the Therapist, led the workshop and made a point to note that even thinking about the experience can trigger a reaction in the body. That was the first sign ever shown to me that your mind can control your body, she said. There is, in fact, no lemon, but I'm thinking of a lemon and my body's reacting like there's a lemon there. Anderson is a licensed mental health therapist and public speaker from the Brockton area. Her workshop, which was given to two groups of juniors at the school, was received well by students, and she returned on February 5th for a round of presentation for seniors, reaching over 800 students. I tried to fit in as many natural, easy stress management techniques as I could and mantras that I live by, Anderson said. We can use things like our breath, sighing, and music. We spoke about the importance of a connection and being a person of your word and not letting people steal your energy or have control over you. The workshop comes following a proposal made by two Southeastern students to the school's guidance department. Two Southeastern students who belong to Students Against Destructive Decisions, SAD, requesting a guest speaker focused on real-life skills, self-management, coping, and resiliency, the district said in a prepared statement. The students, Maeve Cady and Loki Gendreau, worked with the Southeastern chapter of SAD and the nonprofit Constructing Hope to get the proposal to fruition, with sponsorship from the nonprofit High Point Prevention Services. The proposed aligned closely with Southeastern's continued mental health efforts that were established during the school's multi-year partnership with the JED Foundation. JED. Anderson's advice included practical tips like taking time to focus on breathing, listening to upbeat music, and tuning out negative opinions and gossip, according to the district. Meg connected with students in a way that felt real and approachable, and the message clearly resonated, said Lois Miller, director of guidance for the Southeast Regional School District, in a prepared statement. She provided practical tools students can use immediately and reinforced the importance of managing stress in healthy ways. Superintendent Holly McLennan said the strategies are a great way to help students deal with stressors in the classroom as well as in their day-to-day lives. Providing students with real-life coping strategies is an important part of preparing them for success both in and out of school, she said in a prepared statement. We are grateful to our teachers, staff, and community partners who work every day to support our students' mental health. End of article. Next article, what's next for Deaflympics gold medalist from Raynham by Daniel Schemer. The Taunton Daily Gazette. Raynham, it's been such an amazing experience. I'm so honored to be part of it all, said Tia Labreck, 16, about all the attention and accolade she received the last couple of years as a member of the U.S. Women's Deaf National Soccer Team. In November 2025, the Raynham resident competed with her team in the International Deaflympics competition in Tokyo, Japan. Besides being the youngest member of the U.S. team, joining in 2024 when she was just 15, Labreck can now call herself a gold medalist, as her team took home the gold in the women's soccer tournament. Labreck, who made 4 goals and 3 assists during the tournament, was invited to bring her gold medal to Raynham Town Hall on February 10th to celebrate her achievement and receive a certificate of recognition from the town. Her journey reflects the courage to face challenges and the discipline to push through adversity, says the certificate, which was read aloud by the select board member Kenneth Collins, who added, she has turned challenges to strengths in lessons that extend far beyond the soccer field. Labreck was born with bilateral sensorineural hearing loss in both ears. She'd been using hearing aids since being less than a year old. She told the Patriot Ledger in November 2024, "Since I've always had hearing aids my whole life, it wasn't that big of a deal," she said of dealing with her hearing loss. "I was used to it. It was never a hearing problem where I missed a lot of stuff. I always knew what people were saying." Her parents, Kimberly and Jeffrey, were part of a coalition that advocated for and spurred state lawmakers to pass Chapter 233 of the Acts of 2012, an act providing hearing aids for children, mandating that insurance companies pay for hearing aids for people aged 21 and younger. Kimberly told lawmakers at a joint hearing at the State House in 2011, "Our message is that if children are identified for hearing loss early and get hearing aids prior to 6 months of age, it yields significantly better receptivity and better expressive language, vocabulary, speech production, personal and social skills." Tia, a junior at Bishop Feehan High School in Attleboro, told the Gazette on February 10th that she discovered her love of soccer at around age four. "It always gave me the ability to be creative," she said, adding she loved it since day one, and her teammates have always felt like extended family to her. She was playing on the girls' soccer team at Bishop Feehan when she qualified and was picked by the U.S. Women's Deaf National Soccer Team in 2024. When playing on the U.S. team, players that are hearing impaired have to remove their hearing aids in order to give those that are deaf a level playing field. Communication between players is done through sign language and other nonverbal communication. LeBrecq told the Patriot Ledger in November 2024 that the first time she played without her hearing aids, she felt free, and it was a whole new world, but I loved it so much. She is currently the youngest player in the U.S. team, as the ages vary widely, with some players being in their 30s. She said being a member of the U.S. national team requires a lot of travel during the year for practice, training, and games. She told the Gazette that school and her teachers have been so supportive of her and have worked around me and my schedule. On February 10th, Tia LeBrecq received the Raynham Recognition Award from the town's select board. Board Chair Patricia Riley said the award is given to residents, groups, and town organizations for individual acts of courage or achievement or years of dedication and service to the town. "It's to celebrate positive efforts with the goal of promoting respect within the community," said Riley. The idea to award LeBrecq came from Select Board member Kenneth Collins. "I have a soft spot for athletics," he said during the meeting, adding he was inspired by Tia's powerful story of perseverance. Said Select Board member Joseph Pacheco, "The town is very proud to have you as a resident." Tia LeBrecq told the Gazette she wants to be a professional athlete. Besides continuing with the U.S. Women's Deaf National Soccer Team for as long as she can, she said she wants to be the first deaf hearing impaired athlete to play on the regular U.S. Women's National Soccer Team. She said she will go down the path as a full-time athlete when she graduates high school, but she also plans on attending college with the intention of focusing on degrees in business and finance. She said she's excited for her next big international event, the Deaf World Cup in Australia in 2027. End of article. Next article, states take sides in immigration fight. State lawmakers across the country are ramping up efforts to either support or block the Trump administration. This is by Trevor Hughes, by the way. But the Trump administration's mass deportation efforts, wading deeper into policy arena that's long been the province of the federal government. While immigration enforcement is a federal power, states have many opportunities to either smooth the way or throw up roadblocks, particularly when it comes to being a sanctuary jurisdiction. Lawmakers from across the political spectrum said the attention focused on immigration by President Donald Trump and being carried out by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers has created a significant appetite for state-level action. In Republican-led states, White House officials have been working with legislative leaders to target sanctuary jurisdictions where local police won't cooperate with immigration agents. They are also pushing state lawmakers to expand 287 programs which are ICE partnerships allowing local police to take on limited immigration enforcement authority and requiring local sheriffs to hold on to suspected unauthorized immigrants until immigration enforcers can collect them from jail. Republican states like Florida and Texas have long had expansive 287 G programs, and the two states have for years collaborated with the federal government on immigration, in part due to their proximity to Mexico and the Gulf Coast. But other non-border states are increasingly wading in, many of them led by Democrats, pushing plans to bar ICE agents from wearing masks, allowing residents to sue agents in state court over civil rights violations, and further limit cooperation by local police and sheriffs. In Tennessee, Republican leaders have worked with the White House to craft a package of bills aimed at cutting off any state spending on unauthorized residents, in part by creating immigration checks for public school students. Under federal law, all children in the United States are entitled to a free public education, and migrant right groups say efforts to track citizenship might scare immigrant children into staying home. The plans would also permit state and local police to detain truckers who can't immediately prove their lawful status and stop offering driver's license tests in any language except English. Tennessee House leaders said they have consulted with Stephen Miller, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, on how to make their proposals most effective. It's about making sure that those who are here legally, lawfully, have the access to the thing they need to have access to, and not to be detrimental by the illegals coming in and doing that, State House Speaker Cameron Sexton said. For instance, the United States has a limited supply of public housing, Sexton said, and it should be reserved for people who are here legally. You have people in the streets right now who are homeless, who are here legally and lawfully, he said. Can we answer how many illegals are in public housing in our state? Should we know that number? Because that's housing that could be for them, that they could have an opportunity. In Iowa, legislators are considering Republican-backed bills to require greater cooperation between law enforcement and federal immigration officers and require state driver's licenses to display the cardholder's citizenship status. Governor Kim Reynolds has also floated a plan to make it harder for federal judges in criminal cases to release unauthorized immigrants on bond, potentially keeping them jailed no matter how serious the criminal charges. In California, Democrats have proposed laws barring immigration agents from using state property, making it easier for people to sue federal immigration officers, and even blocking car rental companies from renting vehicles to immigration and customs enforcement agents. In Oregon, Democratic lawmakers are considering plans to withhold state grants or contracts with private companies assisting ICE and clarifying that the state will withhold tax payments to the federal government if the White House blocks federal funding to the state over its refusal to comply with Trump's demands. In Colorado, Democrats who control the state house are considering a raft of bills to restrict operations by ICE officers, including further limiting information sharing by state and local governments and barring enforcement at sensitive locations such as hospitals. What I'm hearing is people want us to do everything we can to stand strong against this agency and this administration, said first-generation Iranian-American State Representative Yara Zokeh, a Colorado Democrat. Zokeh is drafting legislation that would also ban ICE agents from ever becoming local or state police officers. In any other year, such sweeping changes wouldn't have a chance of passing the state legislature, she said. But people are upset by what they see as overreach by immigration enforcers. The state has immense power to take a stand against the federal government and to protect our constituents from the federal government, Zokeh said. The state has immense power to take a stand against the federal government and to protect our constituents from the federal government, Zokeh said. And it is because we have that power that Trump threatens to retaliate against us. End of article. Next article, the Guard fully withdrawn from three cities. Deployment continues in others amid legal battles, by Christopher Kahn for the USA Today. National Guard soldiers have fully withdrawn from Los Angeles, Chicago, and Portland, Oregon, military officials said, ending federalized troop operations in half of the cities where the Trump administration launched them last year. The troops competed with completed their withdrawal as of January 21st, according to U.S. Northern Command, which noted the demobilization on its website. The White House did not immediately respond to requests for comment about the troops' departures, which was first reported by the Washington Post. President Donald Trump announced in December that the soldiers would be leaving after the Supreme Court blocked his administration from sending troops to Chicago, ruling its justification insufficient. Trump has credited National Guard members with reducing crime rates, though crime was already trending down in the cities where the soldiers were deployed. "We are removing the National Guard from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Portland, despite the fact that crime has been greatly reduced by having these great patriots in those cities, and only by that fact," Trump said in a social media post in December, adding, "We will come back, perhaps in a much different, stronger form, when crime begins to soar again." The drawdown ends the controversial missions launched over the objections of state and local officials who responded with a series of legal challenges, several of which led to rulings that found the deployments unlawful. But while hundreds of National Guard soldiers have departed from three cities, thousands remain in Washington, D.C., Memphis, Tennessee, and New Orleans under the command of the Republican governors or Trump. Guard troops were first sent to Los Angeles in June following protests over aggressive immigration raids, marking the first time since the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s that a state's National Guard was federalized without a formal request from the governor. The administration launched similar deployments across the country. While the Los Angeles, Chicago, and Portland deployments stemmed from protest, the missions in Washington, Memphis, and New Orleans were tied to broader crime reduction efforts, though immigration advocates and attorneys in those cities also reported increased immigration raids. In Washington, troops were routinely seen picking up trash, laying mulch in tourist areas, and patrolling train platforms. In November, a gunman shot two National Guard troops near the White House, killing Army Specialist Sarah Beckstrom and seriously injuring Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf. Troops in Los Angeles, Chicago, and Portland were federalized under Title 10 status, limiting them from engaging in law enforcement actions such as arrests or searches. Soldiers in Memphis and New Orleans, who remain under state control, have broader authority to detain people. Every deployment except the one in New Orleans has faced significant legal challenges, with multiple judges calling the mobilizations unlawful. On appeal, the Trump administration has received both temporary victories and losses. In December, a federal appeals court allowed National Guard troops to remain in Washington, reversing a lower court ruling that had deemed it unlawful. The same month, the Supreme Court ruled against the administration's use of the National Guard, blocking it from sending troops to Chicago. At this preliminary stage, the government has failed to identify a source of authority that would allow the military to execute the laws in Illinois, the majority wrote in its brief opinion. The administration has appealed rulings by federal judges in Illinois and Oregon that deemed the deployments unconstitutional. Those appeals are pending. The roughly 350 soldiers deployed to New Orleans are expected to leave at the end of February, according to Louisiana state officials. Nearly 3,000 troops in Washington are expected to remain there through the end of the year. No withdrawal date has been set for the 1,500 Guard members in Memphis. The Tennessee Court of Appeals is expected to hear arguments in March on whether to sustain a lower court's order blocking the use of National Guard troops there. Trump's deployments of the military to American cities cost taxpayers nearly $500 million in 2025 and would cost more than $1.1 billion if continued for another year, according to an estimate from the Congressional Budget Office. The estimate found that Trump's deployments of soldiers to five cities, including Los Angeles and Washington, cost around $496 million. According to internal military budget information obtained by USA Today in September, the deployment of National Guard troops to Washington costs more than $1.8 million per day. The CBO analysis found that another year of the Washington deployment will cost roughly $55 million per month, or $660 million for the whole year. End of article. Next article, buyers opting for affordable vehicles. Carmakers report more sales of base models. For American buyers, this is by Nathan Gomes of Reuters, for American buyers, affordable cars have not been this hot since the Gulf War sent gas prices climbing and Japanese automakers took market share by offering a simple proposition. Fill it, forget about it. Steep sticker prices on new cars are pushing Americans to opt out of premium trims for base models, lifting sales of entry-level variants, and prompting some automakers to adjust production. Pickup trucks and crossovers have cemented their place as top sellers despite their hefty price tags. But average transaction prices have hovered around $50,000 for nearly a year, according to Cox Automotive, putting many fully loaded models out of reach. The strain extends beyond the showroom. The widening wealth gap in America and a sharp rise in costs for housing, insurance, and health care are squeezing lower-income households, with President Donald Trump's tariffs adding more pressure. If you want to keep a car for a decade, shouldn't you get the bare minimum of options that you will use? No need to get the most powerful engine if the plan is just to commute to work, said Sam Fiorani, Vice President of Research at Auto Forecast Solutions. For automakers, the shift to entry-level trims is not necessarily bad, since they are cheaper and faster to build. While margins per vehicle may be lower than premium models, higher volumes can help shore up profitability at a time when consumers are tightening their spending. Automakers say the impact is showing in sales. Ford reported lower overall U.S. sales in January, but said deliveries of the basic trim of its compact Maverick pickup rose 33.3%. Honda flagged a similar shift to focus on entry-level models in January. David Whiston, an auto analyst at Morningstar, said affordability was still a key concern for automakers, pushing companies like Honda and GM to focus more on lower-cost offerings. At Toyota, demand for affordable mainstay models like the Corolla and Camry were considerably higher in January, while sales of similar models at its premium sister brand Lexus fell. Stellantis told Reuters it has cut prices over the last 2 years to improve affordability, pointing to lower starting prices on Jeep SUVs, sub-$50,000 Ram pickups, and some entry-level Dodge and Chrysler models. Across several top sellers, the gap between the lowest and highest trims now averages about $5,000, according to Reuters' calculation, based on data provided by Marketplace and automotive data provider CarEdge. I always buy the most base interior, said Chris Smith, 30, from Colorado, who owns a 2020 Toyota Tacoma SR5, citing reliability and lower ownership cost. Most basic spec models now come with just enough onboard tech for most consumers. End of article. Next article, Muslims prepare to observe Ramadan. Moon determines when month of fasting begins. By Melina Khan. Muslims around the world are gearing up for Ramadan, the annual holy month, which is starting in just a few days. Ramadan is a period of prayer, reflection, and abstinence that coincides with the ninth month of the Islamic calendar year. It ends with the celebration of Eid al-Fitr. During the month of Ramadan, Muslims observe a fast from sunrise to sunset, meaning they do not eat or drink at all during the daylight hours. Ramadan is expected to start on February 18th and 19th this year. Because the Islamic calendar follows a lunar cycle, exact dates can change slightly each year depending on moon sightings. Many Muslims follow guidance set by moon sighting committees in Middle Eastern countries. In Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, officials have called for those sighting the moon to gather on February 17th, meaning the start of Ramadan could be declared for either February 18th or 19th. In other countries, such as Oman, Turkey, and Singapore, officials declared the start of Ramadan to be February 19th this year. For some, this year's start of Ramadan could coincide with two other cultural days, Mardi Gras and Lunar New Year. Ramadan is the most sacred time of the year for Muslims. Because fasting is one of the five pillars of Islam, every healthy Muslim adult is expected to partake in the month-long fasting. Ramadan signifies the month Muslims believe the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, according to Brandeis University. During Ramadan, Muslims have a pre-dawn meal called suhoor and a post-sundown meal called iftar. Ramadan lasts 30 days and ends with Eid al-Fitr, the start of a new month in the Islamic calendar. Eid al-Fitr is a major holiday celebrated by Muslims around the world to signify the breaking of the fast. This year, Eid al-Fitr is expected to be on March 18th, 19th, or 20th, depending on Ramadan's start date and, again, on the sighting of the moon. End of article. Next article. Robert Duvall, Oscar winner, dies at 95, by Bill Trott and Reuters. Oscar winner Robert Duvall, a versatile actor who made lasting impressions in a range of parts from starring to supporting roles like the napalm-loving colonel of Apocalypse Now or the spectral Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird, has died at age 95, his wife said in a Facebook post. The actor, who played Tom Hagen, a lawyer for the Corleone family in The Godfather and its first sequel, and starred in the TV miniseries Lonesome Dove, died peacefully on February 15th, according to a statement which did not give the cause of death. For each of his many roles, Bob gave everything to his characters and to the truth of the human spirit they represented, Luciana Duvall said in a post. Duvall played forceful leaders such as Lieutenant Colonel Bull Meacham in The Great Santini and the title character in Stalin, as well as broken down and fallen characters in Tender Mercies and The Apostle. He won awards for both types of roles. Duvall, the son of a Navy admiral and an amateur actress, grew up in Annapolis, Maryland. When Duvall grew weary of Hollywood, he made his own movies. He wrote, directed, and won an Oscar acting nomination for The Apostle, the story of a conflicted preacher. He did the same thing with Assassination Tango, a movie that allowed him to exhibit his passion for the tango and Argentina, where he met his fourth wife, Luciana Pedraza. They were both born on January 5th, but 41 years apart. Duvall split his time between Los Angeles, Argentina, and a 360-acre farm in Virginia, where he converted the barn into a tango dance hall. End of article. Thank you for joining us here at the Talking Information Center, and please enjoy a wonderful day.